Well, I went fishing with my friend Thomas on the beautiful waters of the Monterey Bay. We caught two healthy lingcod, which became the object of some very good meals. But those meals lead me to ask, will our grandchildren taste wild fish?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 692nd edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Subic Bay who are tuned in as we stream along on the radio page at metrofarm.com. Whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Rick O'Shea on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day, Michael.
Ready to go fishing?
I am.
All right. Folks, I always take great joy in fishing the waters of the Monterey Bay. While on those waters, we could be a scant city block from the civilization of the shore, and yet be in the wilds where great white sharks kill to live. Within moments of arriving at our selected spot, Thomas and I each pulled a healthy lingcod out of the water. They were big, handsome fish. We marveled at our good fortune and settled down to spend the day on the bay. Later, while enjoying the baked cod at dinner with my family, I got to thinking about how truly fortunate we were to be enjoying the wild food of the sea. And then I got to wondering, will our grandchildren taste wild fish? Well, who better to ask that question than Paul Greenberg, who is the author of Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. Welcome to the Food Chain, Paul.
Hey, thanks, Michael, and I'm glad to hear you're getting so much fishing in lately.
Not enough, right?
I know, it's never enough.
Never enough, yeah, but we try. So, you know, congratulations on your new book, Four Fish, a fun read. I enjoyed pecking my way through it, yum, yum.
Yeah.
And I noticed that you're going on a big book tour. You toured some of the New York City and Connecticut area. And then you're heading out to here in California, be in Petaluma and San Francisco soon, in L.A., and then up the coast to Portland and Seattle and back to the East Coast to Washington, D.C. and Martha's Vineyard. But what puzzles me is that why aren't you in Kansas City?
Well, it's true. There's a lot of fish being eaten in the center of the country.
But
we're starting on the edges first, where the fishermen are. And then also, it's really where the people are most cognizant of, you know, the issues surrounding the sea. You know, even the East Coast compared to the West Coast is a couple of decades behind in terms of understanding our connection to the ocean.
Well, wait a minute. Which one is behind?
We're behind on the East Coast.
Really?
West Coast. Yeah. You know, to my mind, I mean, I think a lot of it is due to the Monterey Bay Aquarium and a lot of the sort of their Seafood Watch program. But as I've been sort of talking to different people, you know, on the East Coast, I was talking to a fish wholesaler recently who told me he runs a wholesale thing out of Chatham, Mass., you know, where a lot of the codfish and haddock
are. Right, right.
So he had people come down to the dock the other day and asked him if he had any nice, wild, fresh tilapia. And, you know, if you're involved with fish
right,
at all,
okay.
Tilapia, you know, it's a farmed fish.
That's like wild chickens, right?
Exactly. It's like originating from Africa. And so to me that, you know, a customer in the East Coast thinks that tilapia is a wild fish is already a step removed, whereas I think... I mean, I'll test the water, so to speak, when I'm out on the West Coast. But as I've been talking to people in California, you know, because you still have wild salmon, because you have that great... I was thinking when you were describing my book tour, I'm more or less following the path of the longfin albacore, south to north. But, you know, you have these fish really very present in your lives, and it's that connection that, you know, it's most important to me and the connection I'd like to see everybody have.
Well, good. Let's start with your fishing experiences as a youth. You grew up in Connecticut, and you grew up as a fisherman, and as a young person, you got your first boat at the age of 13, which would be, you know, your parents would be thrown in jail for that these days, I suppose, for giving a 13-year-old kid a boat and sending him out on the bay by himself. But that's the way it was then, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I said in the book, I think that, you know, it was not the time of the swallow-proof soda can tabs. You remember those peel-off ones? You just shove into the can and hope you don't swallow it. And, you know, we certainly didn't have any GPS or cell phone. For me, you know, it was sort of my kind of Tom Sawyer moment, you know, or Huck Finn, so to speak, because I set out on my boat, and I was, you know, granted, I wasn't in Pacific waters, which can be a good deal rougher. I was in Long Island Sound, which, you know, is bordered by land on either side. But, well, you know, we get some storms out there, And I remember going out with my brother once across Long Island Sound in the middle of the night, and he's saying, "How do you know? Do you have a compass or anything? Do you have any idea how we're going to get back?" I said, "Well, you know, the lights to the, you know, to the north are Connecticut, and the south is Long Island." But then, of course, there's all these boats around. We got all turned around, and you know, we ended up cruising around Long Island Sound for about 4 hours before we got. We caught a lot of fish though, so that was good for me. But seriously though, getting back to the boat, and I mean, that's really where I kind of developed this very intimate relationship with fish, both as wildlife and as food.
Right. And can anybody relate more with fish than fishermen?
Not at all. And you know, it's funny because as I've been kind of talking to this issue, I find myself getting pegged a little bit on sort of like the lefty side of things as being this sort of, you know, save the fish and save the oceans and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, I am save the fish, save the oceans. But then when people hear that I'm also a fisherman, that I hunt and I can't, you know, I kill fish,
yeah.
I eat the fish, then I get this, oh, how could you kill fish? Don't you practice catch and release and all those kind of things? And yeah, sometimes I practice catch and release. But I actually think the sportsman, the sporting fisherman, is the greatest potential for conservation in the oceans that we have today. Because these are the people who are really out on the sea, really guarding it and really watching it.
And you know, that is true on land as well. Because it was really the sportsmen and the organization, the organizing of sportsmen and hunters that protected wildlife and brought them back from almost extinction.
That's right. And you know, I think about my time, you know, I had a job back in the 80s counting salmon in Oregon for the Bureau of Land Management. And I remember how with the logging interests up there, what they would do is they'd leave a corridor of trees along the highway.
Right, right.
Of big old trees. So you know, if you're just some...
Look at all the trees.
Oh, you know, two Douglas firs. There's tons of forest. But, you know, if you were a hunter, though, right, and you went out past that sort of screen of trees, you'd see that, you know, we were losing deer habitat, we were losing salmon habitat. And I think that's the thing that a fisherman does or a hunter does is that, you know, you're making real use of this. And unless humans use something, then they just use it up. You know, you have to have a productive, useful relationship with nature. Otherwise, it's just something that you kind of stare at through binoculars.
Well, we out here on the West Coast are certainly aware of that with respect. You know, you mentioned the fact that we still have wild salmon. Well, we don't have very many
salmon.
And the ones that we do have are becoming so incredibly precious that and nobody, I think, is more aware of that than the fishermen.
Yep.
But that happened quite some time ago on the East Coast, correct?
That's right. Yeah, we lost our wild salmon. There was actually wild salmon in my home river of the Connecticut River. We supposedly might have had a run as big as 40,000 fish at one point, and these were big fish, you know, 20, 40 pounds, as much as that. But we lost those fish around 1798 when they put a dam across the river, and they pretty much vanished from the face of the earth. Now, around the late 60s, early 70s, they've been trying to restore them, but what I find is a real kind of point of amnesia for people is that there are still a lot of salmon in the marketplace. You know, we see Irish salmon and Scottish salmon and Norwegian salmon.
Everywhere, even in Kansas City.
Exactly. Well, there we go. And the default assumption of everybody is that, oh, yeah, Irish salmon, that must be wild. Wrong. Every single example you see of the species Salmo salar or Atlantic salmon is farmed. It's commercially extinct. It does not exist as a commercial species anymore. So when I say, you know...
I mean, it's completely gone? All gone?
Well, here's the deal. I mean, you know, with fisheries, it's always, you have to be careful about using land terms, you know, terrestrial terms. They're not extinct. They're commercially extinct. In other words, there's probably 500,000 to 1 million wild Atlantic salmon left in the Atlantic Ocean right now.
Mm.
Which, you know, if you do the math, that's not a lot of people, not a lot of fish compared
to them. They must have to swim 3 days to meet each other.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, that's interesting because nearly all the Atlantic salmon in the world converge on a little patch of water just off of Greenland. And it was actually the discovery of that little patch of water that led to the final sort of death knell to Atlantic salmon.
Right,
because when they found all those salmon, they just fished them really hard. And they were already degraded, you know, by the same things that are hurting your salmon, you know, with the dams and so forth. But that was really the thing that kind of knocked them out of the box as a commercial species.
Gone.
But, you know, the thing is they can come back. I mean, what's really interesting, you know, the expression... like coal to Newcastle, you know, it's like Newcastle is a very industrial city in England, famous for its coal. Well, on the River Tyne in England, which goes right past Newcastle, this amazing guy sort of flew in the face of convention and decided, you know, the way we were reintroducing salmon when salmon runs had gone down was all wrong. And the Tynan had a very big salmon run at one point. And what this guy, Peter Gray, realized is that you actually need to kind of retrain salmon how to be wild. And so he basically sort of started physical therapy for salmon smolts.
You're kidding.
No, not at all. And, you know, getting them gradually amping up the current, exposing them to predators, teaching them to hunt. And it seemed like really crazy and really labor-intensive, but today the River Tyne went from about zero fish to a run of anywhere from 10 to 30,000 salmon.
Wow.
I mean, it's incredible, and it really worked. And so I always say that, like, you know, sometimes it can kind of seem like a futile thing or a sort of endlessly depressing thing. Oh, we're losing our wild fish, we're losing our wild fish. If we lose our wild fish, it's our choice to lose them. We can bring them back, and we can also keep what we've got.
And we'll pick it up when we get back. Let's go fishing with Paul Greenberg and Four Fish on the Food Chain right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, let's go fishing with Paul Greenberg, author of Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. Paul, you talked a little bit about the transition you saw on the East Coast in fish markets.
Yeah.
Between, I don't know, when you were a kid selling fish, the fish that you caught on your little boat out there in the Long Island Sound, and when you came back to the fish markets as an adult. What was that difference?
Well, the big change has been that in the last 50 years, we've gone from a fish market that's nearly 100% wild to one that's 50% farmed. So what I started seeing was this kind of repetition of certain species or kinds of fish again and again and again. Salmon always seemed to be in the market.
Mm-hmm.
Some form of something called a sea bass, which increasingly is this farmed fish called the European sea bass, which you might know in the market out there as Branzino, or sometimes called Loup de Mer. That started appearing everywhere. Started to see, well, always some sort of white-fleshed fish that was cod, but increasingly now is tilapia, which is a farm fish. And then lastly, tuna just became incredibly omnipresent, which, you know, is to this day, it's not a farmed fish, but they are starting to domesticate bluefin. And it's just become this sort
which
of thing.
Which is a story in itself. That's kind of like domesticating elephants or something, right?
Well, it's more like, I would call it domesticating cheetah, because, you know, the Atlantic bluefin and the Pacific bluefin, they swim at 40 miles an hour. Some say a little faster. And they also, something a lot of people don't know, is that the bluefin tuna is warm-blooded, which has big implications if you're talking about trying to domesticate an animal. You know, fish actually make pretty good farm animals. They don't have to swim against gravity. They don't have to stand against gravity, rather, so they don't spend any energy on that. They're cold-blooded, by and large. They don't have to spend energy on heat, so they can put all that energy into growing more meat. But a bluefin, meanwhile, you know, is whipping around the cage at 40 miles an hour, you know, heating its body. Somebody likened it to trying to make an ultra-marathon runner put on weight while running the race.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really make very much sense.
And the only reason, of course, people are actually interested in domesticating the bluefin tuna is they're worth about $10,000 a pop, right?
That's right. I mean, you know, it varies from fish to fish. But, yeah, mm-hmm. You know, and frankly, the same thing has happened with every fish we've domesticated, or at least the sort of name brand ones. Salmon, you know, before they were fully domesticated in the 1960s, you know, were a very rare item. There's stories about,
They were kind of a holiday dish, weren't they?
They were a totally holiday dish. I mean, you know, again, I was talking to somebody in British Columbia who said, oh, you know, that was just a cheap fish back then, you know,
right.
Salmon. But for those of us on the East,
those who were living on the rivers, right?
Exactly.
They had the salmon jump out of the river into their...
That's right. They walked across them to get to the other side and then pulled a few out and baked them. But... But no, on the East Coast, you know, the last salmon that we really had on the East Coast that had any commercial viability was the Penobscot River run in Maine. And I remember reading a story about a Gilded Age baron in the 20s paying, you know, an exorbitant amount of money to have some salmon put on ice and railroad freighted back to New York. So that was what salmon had become to people, either that or it was in a can from Alaska, but a fresh salmon was a rarity. And that's what made this huge effort occur in the 60s and 70s, mostly in Norway, to really fully domesticate it. Now, of course, farm salmon's pretty cheap. And that could happen to tuna as to bluefin as well, but it could be to the great detriment of our environment.
How did they go about domesticating salmon?
Well, salmon actually are in a relatively...
I mean, it's a big fish.
It is a big fish. And it eats a lot of food. Back in the early days, it could take as many as anywhere from 3 to 6 pounds of wild fish to grow a pound of salmon. So it's kind of, you know, as a fisherman, that's kind of cockamamie. I mean, we all weigh our bait, you know, cost compared to our fish cost, but that's kind of a little bit over the top. But the thing is, actually, salmon were somewhat easy to domesticate just because they hatch out of a big red egg. Like, have you ever eaten salmon caviar before?
Right.
Yeah, you know, you can put it on toast and stuff. It's a big egg, and it means that when the fish hatch, they have a lot of nutrients, and they can transition from a larval phase directly into a phase where you can just feed them feed pellets. So that was easy. But what was the real breakthrough was a tremendously sophisticated program of selective breeding. Your listeners out there who, you know, raise cattle and sheep and so forth know that those animals are the product of 2,000 years of selective breeding.
Right.
The salmon that we eat today are the product of only 40 years of selective breeding, but they, because fish are short-lived, they produce many, many offspring, they were able to double the growth rate in 20 years.
So they were just picking the biggest, healthiest growing salmon and eating the rest and using the biggest, healthiest ones to breed, and that's the selective breeding, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was an eyeballed kind of thing at first, where, yeah, that one looks healthier and whatever. But I've been to these labs in Norway, and they're actually in Norway, they're trying to do the same thing with cod. Mm-hmm. But in Norway, they had 40 different river systems that they were selecting from.
Oh, wow.
So it was a huge genetic wealth to draw from. I mean, probably more than we have today in the cattle genome.
Do they still have a wild run in Norway?
They do have wild fish. But
not commercially viable.
Exactly, that's
right,
the thing.
Okay.
You know, and in fact, there's a guy named Ori Vigfusson. He's an Icelander who's trying to basically turn Atlantic salmon into a global sport fish. And what he's been doing is trying to buy out netsmen, the few remaining netsmen that are in Ireland and Scotland and Norway, and try and give these salmon a break so that they can again become something like, you know, the common person can enjoy as a sport fish rather than a commercial fish.
Oh. And so how do they confine them?
Oh, salmon?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the aquaculture model...
Big buckets?
Leashes. You know, they have individual leashes. No. No, what they have are these sort of big hoops of nets that are suspended in the water. They're usually, you know, 40 or 50 feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have a central walkway going out. You know, imagine sort of like almost like a lollipop, but a lollipop with lots of buds on it, or almost like a bunch of grapes, actually, like a central stem and little bulbs coming off are those big net pens. And, you know, it looks pretty innocuous, and it can be innocuous, but what's happened is as the price of salmon has plunged, it's made people have to grow more and more salmon in a denser and denser area. And that's where you get your problems of diseases.
That's what I was wondering. You know, they're kind of like cattle feedlots. So
exactly.
The only way they can keep cattle in feedlots like that is to feed them massive quantities of antibiotics.
That's right. And that's happened with the salmon industry, although they...
Same thing, huh?
To my knowledge, they've backed away from the antibiotics to some degree. But the big difference between, say, a confined animal feedlot and a salmon situation is that, you know, there's no animal that a CAFO is going to affect. Like, you know, our wild bison are pretty much gone. There's no disease transmission issue that's going to happen between cattle and some sort of wild cattle out there.
Right.
But with salmon, you know, you farm them where wild salmon grow. And, you know, in the West Coast, in British Columbia. It's a huge issue right now because, you know, they're really starting to see declines in the Pacific salmon run. They're farming Atlantic salmon in the Pacific. Those fish are escaping. There's issues of disease transmission, sea lice. I'm sure you guys know, you know, hear about this probably more frequently than the East Coast, but it's still, it's a big issue, and we've got to figure it out before we sort of rob Peter to pay Paul.
So I would assume that, that these pens must be located in places that have good tidal flows, you know, where the water is flowing in and out quite rapidly.
In an ideal world, but and increasingly more so, they are like that. But you know, the problem is if you put a net in a zone of high current,
the net floats away.
Exactly. You know, you're much more subject to storms. And so, you know, there's two camps right now about what to do about farmed salmon. One camp says let's take it out of the water altogether and put it up into what they call recirculating aquaculture systems. You know, which are just above, they're exactly what they sound like. They're just above ground.
Mm-hmm, tanks,
and,
kind of.
Yeah, they're tanks.
Right.
And, you know, they're energy intensive, but, you know, there are ways to make them more effective. The other camp, you know, the other camp sort of that would say a middle course is let's get the salmon farms out of the migration routes. Let's put them further offshore, which, again, is an expense. It's more energy costs. And then other people are saying, well, you're just shifting the pollution problem from inshore to offshore. So, you know, the jury is somewhat out on which one's going to work.
And, of course, you know, at the end of this discussion, we're going to be faced with the whole notion of talking about, well, who's telling us to do what and what should we do.
Yeah.
And that is the big issue.
Yeah.
About the last four fish, or the four fish that we consume most, and that's what we're talking about today, the future of the last wild food. Go on. I was so honored to eat that ling cod. Wild food, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Paul Greenberg, author of Four Fish and You. If you'd like to talk fish, got fish comments, fish questions, Paul's the guy to ask. 800-624-2665-831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain, and you are welcome to participate. Pick up your phone and join us today. 800-624-2665-831-479-1080. Right back. The last of the wild foods. Four fish. Salmon, tuna, bass, and cod. What is going to happen to them? Will there be any wild fish left for our grandchildren to taste? What do you think? 800-624-2665-831-479-1080. Michael Olson here with Paul Greenberg on The Food Chain. Paul, each of these fish that you lay on the table have a different kind of, or present us with a different kind of eating, right?
Sure. Yeah, and in fact, that's why I try to focus on these four, because I wanted to approach the fish the way the consumer approaches them. So, you know, to me, they represent sort of the four archetypes of fish flesh that we want to see on a seafood menu or at our seafood counter. We want something sort of white and flaky, like a cod that we can deep fry. Fish and chips, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
We want something a little meatier that's, you know, whiter, tends to be white. You know, you guys have your California white sea bass.
Mm-hmm.
We have our black sea bass and American striped bass, but that's sort of the bass category. Then you want to see something that's sort of pink and succulent, like a salmon that you would have smoked or perhaps baked, has a more oil content, so it stands up to baking. And then lastly, you know, you want to see something kind of steaky that you can throw on the grill, or you could eat a sushi, and that's where tuna comes in. So that's really where I came at it, because I think that's really increasing the way people see the seafood market.
And we talked a little bit about salmon. Let's go to sea bass. One of the
sure.
most magnificent seafood meals I've ever had was a dish called whole fish and hot sea bass, or hot bean sauce, put on by a Sichuan Chinese restaurant that was supposed to be one of the seven best in the world. But anyway, they brought this plate to the table and had a whole fish, a sea bass, covered in hot bean sauce. And all the, I still think of that. It was years and decades ago, but magnificent stuff. But now the sea bass we get is something called Chilean sea bass. But it really isn't sea bass at all, is it?
Well, you know, first of all, let's take a step back and say this word bass, you know, in the first place, is kind of a brand name and not really necessarily very useful when it comes to fish taxonomy.
You mean like Ford?
It's like Ford. It's like the Ford of the sea. And, you know, when I did a little bit of research into this, I found that there were eight different taxonomic families that had fish in them called bass, and a lot of them had as much to do with each other as, say, a human has to do with a lemur, you know, like evolutionarily.
Like nothing.
Yeah, like very little. Like, you know, we have hands. We all have hands and eyes and stuff. But so that's how distant they are. And so, you know, this swapping in of the Chilean sea bass for, at first for California white sea bass that happens in the early 80s is just one of many family substitutes that goes on under the name of bass. Mm-hmm. So, you know, first it swapped in for California white sea bass on the West Coast when those populations went down. And then over on the East Coast, we had a moratorium on our American striped bass. And when that happened, that's when the Chilean sea bass spread to the East Coast.
So
it's this way of kind of, I think it, once the name sea bass and bass got established as a commercial name in the marketplace, people were willing.
It was easier to change the fish than the name.
Exactly.
It's like when you go to the fish market or you go to the restaurant, and the special today is Patagonian toothfish.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
Okay, I'll give. Yeah, all right.
Yep. And it's even funnier if you look at other languages. I think that
it's just a Ford, sir. Take it.
That's right. Take the Ford. It drives smooth, you know. And frankly, I think that they do taste similar. I mean, the Chilean sea bass has one weird evolutionary adaptation that makes its culinary thing a little bit more interesting. In that, sea bass don't have this flotation device called a swim bladder. It's like sort of like if you scuba dive, this thing makes you float. So instead, they use oil that they secrete directly into their flesh to make them float. And that basically means they're getting a deep tissue marinade their whole life. So they, so those fish, it's almost impossible to overcook them. And they became very popular on cruise ships because, you know, they could sit in the buffet tray for hours at a time without drying out. So that was, you know, they opened up their own little culinary niche after a while. But
you tell a very interesting story about the sea bath with respect to their flotation devices.
Yep.
And how that flotation device essentially allowed people to wipe them out of the Mediterranean.
Yes. So the fish that we're talking about, the sea bass in the Mediterranean, is called the European sea bass, as I mentioned earlier. It's also called the branzino or the bleu de mer in French restaurants. But, they have a swim bladder. They use it to, you know, regulate their depth. But what happened in...
How does that work exactly?
Oh, how does it work? Well, they can actually produce gases that they... From their metabolism and basically injected into this little balloon in their stomach, and the balloon inflates and it makes them float. And it's like, have you ever gone scuba diving before?
Yeah.
So you know that you there's something you use when you scuba dive called a buoyancy compensator, a VC vest. And you know if you want to float, you press the button and it fills up your little vest with air, and so you can achieve what's called neutral buoyancy, and you don't have to spend any energy sort of thrashing around trying to go up or down. And that's what these fish do. But in the 70s in the Mediterranean, sea bass populations got to be so low that the only way to catch any number of them was to throw a stick of dynamite in the water. And what that would do is knock the sea bass unconscious, and they would lose regulation of their swim bladders, inflate their swim bladders, and float to the surface. And then the fishermen just came on, so-called fishermen would come and scoop them up and speedboat them back to Italy.
And, of course, otherwise, the fish would be hiding in the crevices of the rocks and whatnot, and it would be almost impossible to fish them out of those crevices where they were hiding for protection during the day.
That's right, and this goes back to the thing we were talking about before about commercial extinction. You know, if there's an abundance of fish, there's not going to be a cranny for every bass.
Right.
And so some of them are going to be able to be catchable by fishermen. But when the numbers get so low that you have to throw a stick of dynamite into the water, you know, that's not, to me, a commercially viable thing to do, because once you throw a stick of dynamite, you're killing everything, and then you're going to bust up the reefs, and, you know, that's pretty much the end of the shooting match as far as I'm concerned.
Which gets us back to some of the industrial commercial ways of fishing.
Yeah.
With respect to the nets and the kinds of the drag nets that we use to kind of drag along the bottom. You made the wonderful reference that it's kind of like a... clear-cutting the Serengeti Plain and chopping down everything and collecting everything just to get a few wildebeest and
kill
all the elephants and kill all the lions and kill everything else just to get the wildebeest.
That's right. You know, that actually original image came to me from a great writer named Charles Clover. And, it's like dragging a net along the forest, or in, you know, Pacific Northwest, you drag it along the Doug Fir Forest and tear up everything and pull out a few deer. And that's the kind of thing that I think we need to see stop. I mean, again, I go back to this question of, like, you know, are fishermen liberals or conservatives? Well, a lot of times, you know, I think sport fishermen knee-jerkly side with the commercial fishermen because, you know, we don't want the government regulating you know, what we can catch. But in fact, actually, if sportsmen don't stand up for their fish,
there aren't going to be any fish.
There aren't going to be any, and they're just going to be taken away. And I heard this very chilling thing that a fisheries manager once said. It's like, well, there are two options in fisheries. You can either manage for high abundance and a good sport fishery, or you can manage for low abundance and a good commercial fishery. And that just struck me as just kind of like, oh, in other words, we're going to manage so that there's really no fish left for the sport fishermen to catch and have it be monopolized by a few, you know, big fishing interests that get everything and sort of dole out a little bit of fish here and there for the occasional sport fishermen to catch one.
And since those real big sport commercial fishermen have the financial firepower donate liberally to their favorite politician.
That's right.
Guess who's going to get their way? Unless sport fishermen stand up and say, hey, right?
Exactly. And, you know, I also think, you know, I was talking about this with a friend the other day. That, you know, you think back to the whole spotted owl debate. Remember that back in the 80s? And again, it polarized sportsmen, I think, who were also working in the logging industry were like, stupid spotted owl, you know, it's getting in the way of our industry and da-da-da, that's how I make a living. But I think that was a mistake.
Hold that.
Yeah.
Because I have to take a quick break.
Yeah, sure.
When we get back, the spotted owl and wild fish. Right back. Do stay tuned, folks. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. So here's a question. What does a spotted owl have to do with salmon, tuna, bass, and cod? Beats me, but that's my job to be confused and wanting to know. I'm Michael Lolson. I'm host of The Food Chain. And today I have Paul Greenberg, who is the author of Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. And he has an answer of what the wild or the spotted owl has to do with those fish. Paul, you got me stumped. What is it?
Well, so, you know, I was counting salmon back in the 80s for the Bureau of Land Management through the Student Conservation Organization, and that was when the whole spotted owl thing was going on. Mm-hmm. And what we realized as we were doing, looking at all these timber sales, that the real species that was suffering from all this timber
Was not really the spotted owl at all.
It was not the spotted owl, it was the salmon. Yeah. And in fact, you know, you heard about recently I heard that what's going on with spotted owl now is that all these barred owls have moved north with the climate change, and they're eating the spotted owl.
But
meanwhile, you know, salmon still have a shot up here. But what happens is with all this logging, particularly right next to the river, is that, you know, they take all the big trees that normally fall into the river and make these nice snags where salmon juvenile like to hang out. And I always feel like, you know, back in the day, if you had appealed to sportsmen, you know, and again, I don't like the fact that salmon has become this elite fish. Like, it used to be a common person's fish. Everybody used to be able to catch salmon. Right. And everybody should have a right to catch salmon. But, you know, because it's scarce, it's become this sort of, like, you know, white-collar fish. And it shouldn't be. And so I feel back in the 80s, people trying to save the forest really should have been looking at, like, let's save those rivers in the forest so that everybody, you know, logger or not logger, can have a chance to catch a salmon with their son.
Amen to that.
Yep.
Amen to that. Wow. Yep. Well, we've been talking about salmon. We talked sea bass. Let's talk about cod and Cape Codless.
Yeah. Well, cod is the unfishy fish. It's the industrial fish that pretty much we built our country on. Southern slave plantations were completely fed. Their protein source was dried cod harvested off of the coast of Newfoundland, and that supply held up until about the 70s and 80s, and then we had huge East Coast cod crashes all up and down, I mean, both in Europe and in Canada and the United States. So what's happening today, that story's been told before. It was in that book, Cod, by Mark Polansky, some people might have read. But the story I tried to do is sort of like post-cod, you know, what are we doing now? And that's where the Pacific Coast comes in, because turns out everything that's in a filet-o-fish sandwich today or in a fish stick, is this fish called the Alaska pollock, which is... You know, it's related to cod. But, you know, they're starting to really hit those fish really hard. And Monterey Bay Aquarium has just changed their rating. They used to call them best choice, and now they're, quote, good alternative. I love these, you know, these euphemisms. But why the change? And the reason is there are a bunch of things. I mean, they're as you said, when fishing money gets concentrated into a few hands, they have an ability to really, you know, shape regulation to some degree.
Sure, and they're by politicians.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know that they've actually bought a politician outright, but they've certainly, you know,
sought... Well, they influence
They've influenced, and they've sought exemptions from things like, you know, different kinds of regulations. And they've also set, you know, the Northeast or Northwest Pacific Fisheries Management Council has set pretty aggressive quotas for pollock. Even though they've cut them in half, there's some evidence to suggest that, you know, those fish really can't stand up to that kind of industrial pressure. And so what you've seen now with pollock starting to be questioned, now tilapia, which is a farm fish, mm-hmm. and also in Europe is another fish that's a, well, it actually comes from Vietnam. It's called a pangasius catfish. It's also sometimes you see it on the market as tra or bassa. Those white flesh fish have started to come onto the market as substitutes. So what we see in the next 10, 15 years is going to be a very interesting market, I think, for white flesh fish.
So you see a transition. Well, is there a hope for the cod on the east in the Atlantic?
Yeah, there is. In fact, you know, they've closed big chunks of Georges Bank, mm-hmm. Which is the codfish ground that I fish, or at least the stock that I fish.
Which was the great, one of the great fisheries of the world.
Great fisheries of the world. You know, like that this huge cod they have, I think, there's a wooden cod at the Boston State House that sort of represents, you know, the wealth that cod brought to Boston.
Right, right.
And they closed big chunks of those grounds, I think, in the late or the early 90s. And we're starting to see them come back. I fish in the wintertime off New York, and we didn't have any run of cod for really to speak of for about 15, 20 years. These last 3 years, we've had really good runs of cod off Montauk Point, off of Long Island. And I even caught a cod in the shadow of New York City. You know, when you're at the top of your show, we're talking about being able to fish in Monterey Bay,
right.
You know, see the buildings there.
Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, I could see, you know, the Empire State Building from where I caught my codfish. So I saw that as a sign of improvement. And, you know, the Gulf of Maine stock, which is a separate stock that, you know, people catch mostly off New Hampshire and Maine, that's considered even more rebuilt than the Georges Bank. It's still got a ways to go, but there is potential if we don't just start hitting them again with really big boats again. If we can keep the fishing pressure modest, then I think we could have a cod fishery again.
So there seems to be this conflict developing between, I hate to say it, but it seems like the commercial element of feeding the masses.
Yep.
And feeding selective people.
Yeah.
And that seems to be where we're going with this conflict. Can we fish en masse,
yes,
for giant stocks, or do we have to do something to conserve those wild stocks so there's something left for our grandchildren to taste? And I guess that's the question that we'll ask when we get back from this break. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. Today we're talking with Paul Greenberg, the author of Four Fish, about the future of the last wild food. And for those of you who haven't had the opportunity to catch and eat wild food, like get out on the bay or on the ocean or in the rivers while you still can and catch a fish, and it might just change your life, my taste of that wild food. This is The Food Chain. Pick up your phone. We have a couple minutes left if you want to make a comment. 800-624-2665-831-479-1080. Michael Olson, Paul Greenberg, right back. Do stay tuned. Well, salmon, tuna, bass, cod. Will any of these fish be left in the wild for our grandchildren to taste? Or will they all be manufactured in some kind of factory in Kansas City, Kansas? That's the question of the day. What do you think, Paul Greenberg? Will any be left for our grandchildren to taste?
I think there will be. I mean, I try to be optimistic about these things, and since I've seen incredible recovery.
We like people who try to be optimistic, Paul.
No, but I mean, I've physically seen it. You know, the American striped bass, which when I was a kid and fishing for them, I couldn't catch them. They weren't there. There were only 5 million of the fish left. And you know, when they scaled back commercial fishing, did some habitat restoration, we now have, you know, 55 to 70 million fish out there. You know, it's a mm-hmm. huge, huge improvement. So I've seen it. I've seen that we can bring fish back. We don't have to fish things down to the bone. And I also think we can reverse the environment. You know, the River Tyne I was talking about before, you know, with this great salmon recovery in an industrial area of England, it's possible to do.
So what about, I mean, we can fight to bring back fish in our coastal waters, but
yeah.
What about out there in the deep blue seas,
yeah,
where pirates run free and catch all the fish that they want to, wherever they want to?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, and there we are with our last fish, tuna, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because tuna cross the oceans. Your tuna, your bluefin that might show up off of Southern California has likely taken a little visit to Japan at some point. And along the way, they can just run into everything and anything.
40 miles an hour.
Yeah, 40 miles an hour, you know. And that's their sprint, I should say. They tend to cruise a little slower. But you know, there's many, many nations fishing these fish all at once. The regulations, there are these regional fisheries management organizations that supposedly allocate quotas, and sometimes it works, but a lot of times it doesn't. And that's where I think we need a kind of a different ethic altogether, that's kind of a global ethic if we're going to preserve some of these big fish. And that's why the whole last chapter kind of talks about, compares the effort to save the Atlantic bluefin, which is the most poorly off tuna right now, but compares it with the whales, the Save the Whales movement.
Sure, sure.
Because, you know, up until 1986, you know, many, many nations hunted whales, and now only three do, and they're in violation of international law as they do it.
So never did taste whale, did you?
I didn't. I would, you know, it shows up in the book. I was offered whale carpaccio, and I was so close to ordering it. But yeah, you know, the ethics around it kind of helped.
And then the waitress came up, hey, so you want to try the whale?
And I was like, you know, and just when she put it, somehow it was in my mind kind of circulating around, but when she made it verbal as a whale, I'm not going to go for the whale. I'm sure it's good. But, you know, again, it's like, does everything have to be food? I mean, I don't want to, again, you know, fall in the realm of saying that, you know, we should just be saving every fish as wildlife. But I think we need to kind of reevaluate it and see it not necessarily as industrial product, but as game. You know, like, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, if you're a hunter, you know that you can't industrially hunt deer or you can't do it to bison, because we used to have 60 million head of bison in this country,
right.
And now there's, you know, a couple hundred thousand, you know. So, you know, that's what happens. That's the end game of this kind of industrialization of wild food.
And so to have fish for the masses, it sounds like we're going to have to farm them.
We will, but we need to choose different species. I'm not convinced that salmon is really the best aquaculture species out there. Aquaculture is the word for fish farming.
Right.
But there are fish that grow better in captivity, like the Arctic char is a good fish that works mm-hmm. better in these closed recirculating systems. If we go back to the question of cod, you know, they've been trying to tame cod, but they find that, you know, cod have a really big head.
Right,
so
right.
If you're growing a, you know, piece of food,
we just ran out of time, Paul.
Okay.
Paul Greenberg, Four Fish. Pick it up and read it. It's a fun reading. And then go fishing. Michael Olson, this has been The Food Chain. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.